Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It's Friday, which means it's Free for All Friday here on the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. Let me let you know, I love being married. I love my wife. I love my children. I would not trade family life for anything on this earth. But I have had to trade some things in order to have a married life. So I remember before I was married, I would stay up till all hours of the night playing video games with my friends, and we would, you know, go down to Circle K to get food. You know, now for me, Circle K is a place where I go to get gas. But back then it was, oh, we'll be fine. We'll get some Doritos. We'll get some Mountain Dew. We'll get some Twinkies. We're set. And then we would play video games for all hours of the night. I haven't done that in a very long time. But I do have my Super Nintendo still at home. I remember when I was 7 years old, I was in front of the Christmas tree. This is one of the few presents I still viscerally remember opening up on Christmas morning. So my parents' house in Encinitas, California, sitting in the living room, they had these big bay windows and the sun was coming through the bay windows. It was like 6:30, 7 in the morning. And I opened up the box and was just ecstatic to see this black box, purple letters, Super Nintendo Entertainment System. And my dad went and we plugged it in, and the RCA jacks on the TV. We might have even had to use like a coaxial cable modifier. I don't know. But I remember little RCA jacks, red to red, white to white, yellow to yellow, putting that in there and played the game that came within the box. And I was hooked ever since, or at least until, I don't know, 2009, 2010. I wasn't even married then. I got married in 2013, but I kind of grew out of video games a bit, though. I remember in college, I played the video game Halo on the Xbox series. I played that through all hours of the night because I moved away from my friends in Phoenix, Arizona to go on mission work, doing my pro-life mission work. So one way I connected with them was that with Halo, you can play on a multiplayer system online. And so I would go and I had my headset on and I could find them by searching for their names. And we would be able to play games together as a team, just like we did when we all played together, except now we weren't sharing a communal bottle of Mountain Dew and a communal bowl of Doritos chips. But that was something I grew up with that I enjoyed. So I thought today would be fun on Free For All Friday is to talk about the history of video games, and including in them what are some of my favorite video games, and also games that I think are just kind of influential in the history of video games. And it's a big deal. The largest demographic, actually, that plays video games now are women, if you count cell phone games like Candy Crush. But these video games were the progenitors. These were the things that provided the foundation for the video game industry. So today, even if you don't play video games, consider this a history lesson to know how the industry rose and how video games evolved over time and which ones have taken the mantle to be the best games, the best video games out there, greatest ones of all time. So let's start our list. Number one, 1972. I'll play you a commercial for it.
You're watching the most exciting game you will ever see on your TV set. Telstar by Coleco, with three different games. Telstar Tennis, with digital scoring, variable speeds. Telstar Hockey. Each player controls a goalie plus a forward on the other side. Oops, a goal. And Telstar Singles Handball, a game you play yourself. Telstar Handball, Tennis, Hockey. All three at an exciting low price. For great family fun, hitch your TV to a Telstar.
So this is, of course, this game by Telstar's derivative of Pong, which was developed by Atari. So 1972, Pong, number one on our list. We're going chronologically. We'll start in 1972 and we'll end in the 2007 before we get to the 2010s, because I kind of dropped off the map there and stopped playing video games at that point. And there's not a lot that's supplanted the original games being the greatest of all time. Pong was the first commercially successful video game, which helped to establish the video game industry, along with the first home console, which was the Magnavox Odyssey. Others tried to copy the gameplay, so Atari encouraged its staff to produce more innovative games. During the 1975 Christmas season, Atari released a home version of Pong exclusively through Sears retail stores. It was a commercial success, led to numerous copies, and was released on home and portable platforms. So Pong, of course, is just table tennis. So I think the very first video games started the idea, okay, let's take things people like skiing or baseball, and we'll just allow you to do it on your home console. And that's what Pong was. So I guess it's an improvement on table tennis that in the game is so simple. It's a square, dotted lines in the middle. You control a little line that goes up or down, and you have to deflect the dot and get it past the other guy's paddle. And then you win. Simple as that. And unlike regular table tennis, you don't have to go scouring for the ball when it flies off the table. So that is number one. Flash forward from 1972 to 1980, our number two game on the list that changed gaming history. Let's play that right now. And of course, you recognize that munching sound. That is Pac-Man, debut in 1980. We're here. We're not replicating a sport or a game people would normally play. Instead, you have a character. You are the Pac-Man. And you would go and chew these little dots, or actually pucks. You would go and chew them, and you had to keep away from the ghosts. It was, what were their names? Inky, Blinky, Clyde. It was like Stinky, Inky, Blinky, Clyde. I know I have three of them right, and one of them rhymes with Inky. So if you can remember all four of the ghosts from Pac-Man by memory, see if you can put that down at trendhornpodcast.com. According to Wikipedia, Pac-Man is a maze arcade game developed and released by Namco in 1980. I love this. The original Japanese title of Puck-Man was changed to Pac-Man for international releases as a preventative measure against defacement of the arcade machines. So Pac-Man, you think, well, why is it called Pac-Man? Originally, it was called Puck-Man, P-U-C-K, because the little yellow guy goes through and he eats these little dots, and they're little pucks that he eats, and he tries to get away from the ghost. But you can imagine some naughty 1980s kids in the arcade from Stranger Things seeing a game called Puck-Man, and then, well, we're off to the races with them. Number two, Pac-Man, 1980. Going forward, 4 years, 1984, people like puzzles, and so, of course, we have to get probably one of the most famous puzzle games in the history of video games. I'm sure you'll know this, even if you've never played it. I'm sure that you've heard the theme. So let's see. Can you recognize that, I'm hoping? Let's see. We'll play it through right here. Yes, of course, it's Tetris. June 1984, Alexei Pajitnov, an artificial intelligence researcher working for the Soviet Academy of Sciences in Moscow, was testing new hardware and did so by writing simple games for them. He originally wanted to create a game around pentominoes. So think of a domino, right? It has two squares connected. A pentomino has five squares connected, but it would be too complicated. So he used tetrominoes, which are shapes that have four connected squares. There are seven of them, like a little cube, a line, and Z's and L's. So he used these tetrominoes. It was eventually combined with his favorite game, tennis. Tennis, tetrominoes, that's where you get Tetris. The Electronica 60 on which he was working had only a text-based display, so the tetrominoes were formed of letter characters. Realizing that completed lines resulted in the screen filling up quickly, Pajitnov decided to delete them, creating a key part of Tetris gameplay. So Tetris is, of course, a puzzle game. You have falling tetrominoes, Z's and L's and I's and little boxes, and you got to fill them up and not leave any gaps. When you fill up four high, it disappears and you get a Tetris. And so that's what you do, and you try to last as long as you can until the blocks stack and then they hit the top of the Tetris board. That's the goal in Tetris. And I had a Game Boy growing up, and I was obsessed with this game. So by the way, you may be wondering, can you play Tetris forever? This question was asked in 1992 in a thesis completed by John Brzozowski. He said that you cannot. So no matter how you play, you will eventually lose the game of Tetris. The reason has to do with the S and Z tetraminos or tetrominos. If a player receives a sufficiently large sequence of alternating S's and Z's, the naive gravity used by the standard game eventually forces the player to leave holes on the board. The holes will necessarily stack to the top and ultimately end the game. So when you're playing Tetris, I always hit it like, no, how am I getting three Z's in a row? Come on, man. And so you play Tetris, those blocks, because you have the Z's and the S's, when they end up in a random sequence, eventually they will prevent you from getting perfect Tetris eyes, and the game will end. But now it's time to go forward 6 years to 1990. And this was the first game that I got addicted to playing video games, because it was the game that was included in the Super Nintendo console box, the one to cut your teeth on. Here it is right now. Oh, you heard the blink? I am an 8-year-old child huddled up in the guest bedroom at the second floor of my parents' house, furiously playing through Super Mario World. Now, on the Nintendo console, the Mario games had been around for a while, and they were beloved. Well, maybe Mario 2 wasn't beloved, because that was a weird one. But Mario Brothers 3 was a beloved game. It was featured in a movie with Fred Savage called The Wizard, which is basically just a long commercial for Nintendo where they actually hyped up Super Mario Brothers 3. Super Mario World, however, was the release of the Super Mario Brothers franchise onto the Super Nintendo, and it was able to take advantage of the 16-bit graphic system. Nintendo Entertainment Analysis and Development developed the game, led by director Takashi Tezuka, and a name you've heard on the podcast before, producer and series creator Shigeru Miyamoto. He came up with Donkey Kong. He was behind this stuff. He's behind another game we're going to come up right after this. And so the game is just fascinating because it has that Super Mario World. You're Mario. You run through the level, you jump on the Goombas, you get the coins, and you got to go rescue the princess. It's simple. And you can play it through once with a simple beat-em-up kind of formula. Jump on the Goombas and the Koopas, go beat the bad guys, rescue the princess. But because of the graphics, there are many puzzles almost within every level. And you can explore hidden ways out of the levels, get keys to unlock the Star Road. You can go in the haunted houses, and there are multiple exits that will change the path that you take in the game. It provided a lot more creativity in the player to explore, and really tapped into that primal human urge we have of wanting to explore. That's how humans have always been, right? What's on the other side of that mountain? What's on the other side of that ocean? What's on the other hidden part of this level? We all have that desire, and video games allow us to tap into that desire to explore when most of us don't have the resources, freedom, or the wherewithal to want to explore somewhat hazardous areas of our world. We can take that on, and video games serve that function of being a catharsis, a release for us for desires we have we may not be able to satisfy in the real world. They are not escapism, or at least they are abused when they are used as escapism. They can be a form of catharsis, just like a good book or just like a good movie. Our next entry debuts at number 5, 1 year after Super Mario World. Can you recognize this theme? That, of course, is The Legend of Zelda, A Link to the Past from 1991. The Legend of Zelda is a fantasy action video game created by Japanese game designers Takashi Tezuka and, you guessed it, Shigeru Miyamoto. It's primarily developed and published by Nintendo, though portable installments have been outsourced to other companies. The gameplay incorporates action-adventure and elements of role-playing games. It centers on Link, not Zelda. Link, the elf-like player, character, and chief protagonist, Link is often given the task of rescuing Princess Zelda and the Kingdom of Hyrule from Ganon, an evil warlord-turned-demon, who is the principal antagonist of the series. Now, you might say, well, that sounds a lot like Mario, right? Mario goes, rescues Princess Peach from Bowser. Link goes, rescues Zelda from Ganon. What's the difference? Well, the difference really summarized well in a review at IGN talking about this game, which, by the way, I never got into Zelda. I'm not dogging Zelda. I'm not dissing it. It's a great game. That's why it's on my list here. I recognize it as one of the greatest video games of all time. I just never got into it as a kid. I was probably stuck playing Mario. I never got into Zelda. But it's different from Mario in crucial respects, and it deserves a slot on the list for this reason. According to IGN, this iteration of Hyrule, the 1991 game, was more than just moving between enemy-filled screens. It encompassed everything an immersive experience should be. A vast open world that teased you with secrets hiding just beyond your reach, begging you to come back with new and inventive tools. Each zone, whether in the cheerful overworld, dimly lit caves, or the intimidating dark world, was brought to life through a culmination of details, like the sound of the tempered sword cleaving the air, the catchy jingle of a puzzle well solved, and the ambient tunes of Koji Kondo's score. This version of Hyrule, more than any other before or since, is the one I fell most in love with, says the author of this IGN review article. So here, Mario incorporated elements of exploring other worlds, but you're still kind of trapped going level to level and seeking things through. Zelda opened up for games the idea of more of an open world format, and that's going to come back here in other games I talk about on the list, to once again get you into that mindset of wanting to be able to explore and discover and try new things and strategies and feel like you're not just a puppet on a string or just playing a game in a box, that you're entering a completely different world. And now number six, can you guess this one? That's right. It's time to fight. And by that, I mean it's time for Street Fighter. Street Fighter II is a competitive fighting game developed by Capcom and released for arcades in 1991, later on the Super Nintendo console in 1992. It was based on the 1987 game Street Fighter, which nobody remembers. But it expanded on it because it added multiple playable characters, each with their own fighting style. And I got hooked on this. When, you know, Super Mario was one that I loved playing, but I love playing Street Fighter. Today, there are people who will do fighting game tournaments for big amounts of money, and they are masters of pushing the buttons in the right combination to get the right block of a move and execution of a special combo or attack move within milliseconds of a special window that they need to hit to decimate their enemy. And they're basically like athletes, I would say. I would say that if an archer is an athlete because they have wonderful aim and muscular precision in firing an arrow, these guys are on par there, I would say. I mean, it's not the same as archery, but they have heightened their skills, people who do these kind of tournaments. And so I loved it. And Street Fighter II laid the groundwork for a whole series of games. This includes things like Tekken, and of course, Mortal Kombat. Mortal Kombat was like Street Fighter, but you had a ton of blood and guts, and that brought the attention of censors at the time. I'll play a clip here from the 1993 Senate Committee on Violence in Video Games, and they're none too happy about all this.
Second, let me say that I share Senator Lieberman's outrage at the excerpts that we will be viewing on the TV. Mortal Kombat and Night Trap are not the kind of gifts that responsible parents give. Night Trap, which adds a new dimension of violence specifically targeted against women, is especially repugnant. It ought to be taken off the market entirely, or at the very least, its most objectionable scenes should be removed. But those games are only two examples. Let me tell you about another video game called Lethal Enforcers. It comes with a special piece of hardware, an oversized handgun called the Justifier.
Well, and actually, I had games that included gun elements with them. I played with the Super Scope, which was almost like a bazooka. That thing was awesome. But he's right, though. Like, there was that one game, Night Trap. You can see clips of it online. Night Trap is a weird game. It was a weird puzzle game where it showed actual videos. It was able to store on there videos of like girls at a slumber party, and you activate traps to keep augurs, which are like these weird vampires creatures. They look like a cross between a vampire and a special forces person, from attacking these women. The most objectionable part of the game is that it's at a girl's slumber party and they're all kind of like scantily clad. So yeah, creepy. That's not cool, guys. And so they have this there, and you're not supposed to attack the girls. You protect the girls from the augurs who are trying to attack them, but still creepy and weird. So Night Trap got people's attention in 1993, and Mortal Kombat, because Mortal Kombat, they're like, finish him. And then the finishing moves, you grab the guy's head and you rip his head off and his spine is attached. And yeah, you could see why you got to have a rating system and parents should be responsible. Of course, this is back in the day when parents would buy video games or send kids to movies and not know squat about them. You know, nowadays, if I'm going to show my kids something, it's like either I have seen it for myself all the way through, or I have read a review of it and I know that it's kosher. But back then, it's like, oh, Mortal Kombat. These people don't know how to spell. Combat starts with a C, not a K. But fine, Jimmy, whatever you want. And then you see people ripping each other's heads off. So that was part of that milieu, but Street Fighter really provided the framework for the fighting games within that. So Street Fighter didn't get that much attention at the hearing because it didn't have any blood. Rather, it was Mortal Kombat and some of these other games. All right, number eight. So now we've gone through 70s, 80s, and early 90s. We'll get to the later 90s here. Greatest video games of all time. Next one for 1997, I'm going to have to say, is GoldenEye. So that's the intro on Nintendo. Rareware. You turn the game on and you're like, I'm gonna be James Bond. Yeah. So basically when you, well, here you can hear that a little, he's shooting. Okay, well, bring that down here a bit. So GoldenEye was based off of the mid-90s James Bond movie with Pierce Brosnan, which is probably the best Pierce Brosnan James Bond movie, GoldenEye. That's not saying much because the others are really bad. So you go through and you reenact the movie, basically, and so it's a first-person shooting game, but it had elements that really changed how first-person shooters worked, how you would take different weapons, and that the game also encouraged stealth along with brute force. So you had other games like Doom, which is go shoot the monsters from hell and blow them away with whatever you got. But GoldenEye, and then so that was in 1997, was GoldenEye. A year later, Metal Gear Solid came out. I was not a big GoldenEye person because I didn't have a Nintendo 64 at home, so I didn't play GoldenEye a lot. I played it at my friends' houses every single chance I got because that game was awesome because it had a multiplayer mode. So you could have up to four people on a split screen and you could either shoot each other or you did different games like The Living Daylights, which is kind of like Capture the Flag, Man with the Golden Gun. You had these variants of shooting each other in this multiplayer setup like, I got you, oh, I've got you. And I mean, I did multiplayer first-person shooter games for a long time. I played Halo, as I said, all through college and log in with my friends to do that. And GoldenEye, the 1997 game from Rareware, really laid the foundation for that. But whenever you play, now when kids play multiplayer games, you don't have to go over to somebody's house to play. You log on to the internet and you can just stay at each other's houses and you play. And I mean, that's good if you're separated by distance, but not if you can actually spend time with one another. And of course, though, when we all played together, you always heard someone say, dude, you're screen hacking. Stop looking at my screen to know where I am, man. So, but GoldenEye and Metal Gear Solid, which came out a year later, developed the action-adventure genre to include the multiplayer element in GoldenEye, but especially put forward more in Metal Gear Solid that you had to be careful in that game. You have to fight the terrorists, but you could alert them to your presence. You had to sneak around them. Here's some of that gameplay from Metal Gear Solid, which I played endlessly as a kid. That's the hapless guard. I love it. He's like, huh, what was that noise? And you try to get away from him. So basically, if a guard sees you, they go, who's that? And then it's an alert and everybody swarms in. They try to shoot you. So that game really encouraged that you can't go through and mow people down with your gun and just shoot them up. You have to be sneaky and stealthy and get around the bad guys and use the camera to sneak and even put on a cardboard box to hide from them. Yeah, there were some dopey elements to the game. But so I'm going to put number eight, kind of a tie between GoldenEye and Metal Gear Solid, 1997, 1998. How did games start changing? We got two more on our list to show you how games really ended up changing the progression in the history of video games. The next one is Grand Theft Auto 3, debuted in 2001. Grand Theft Auto 3, of course, is a trilogy. There are two games before it, but this one took advantage of the PlayStation console to create a huge open world format where you were basically a criminal that would go through Liberty City. You go through this fictional city and you could walk up to cars and carjack them. You could steal somebody's car and drive around, and you went on these little missions, and it had a huge open world feel to it. And so the game, I should praise it for its open world elements that really define the genre and help people see, oh, you could really create that immersive world. It feels like you're in another world. You're not stuck on a level going from beginning to end. You can walk around, go out to people. You can do what you want. Now, where the game deserves legitimate criticism is its glorification of violence and sex. And so that's why this is not a game to give to little Johnny, okay? We got, according to Wikipedia, Grand Theft Auto 3 received critical acclaim with praise for its concept of gameplay, but the game generated controversy with criticism depicted at its depictions of violence and sex. It became the best-selling game of 2001 and has sold over 14.5 million copies. The game, the open-world format was definitely improved in Grand Theft Auto Vice City and San Andreas, but I will have to say for these games, the Grand Theft Auto series, they get an O, morally offensive, as the USCCB Bishop's Office would put on here. But I have to include it in here because even has morally offensive elements. It was an integral player in the history of video games and how they ended up developing. So there's a lot of moral degeneracy in the Grand Theft Auto series. Don't let your kid play them. But if you are an adult and you can play responsibly and choose to not indulge in the more immoral aspects of the game, which the player seeks out, usually the game doesn't make you do these immoral things. I don't know about the latest Grand Theft Autos. They may make you, like the ones that came out just a few years ago. But I remember Grand Theft Auto 3, the most morally objectionable parts were the parts where you, the player, went and sought them out, and they weren't necessarily necessary for the game. So I enjoyed it, but of course, a bit of moral caution when it comes to that game to share with others. And finally, the last one on here, the number 10, released in 2007, is Portal. So Portal is an awesome game. If you don't play video games, you say video games are dumb. This is a puzzle game I would recommend for you, especially its sequel, Portal 2. But I'm going to give the nod to Portal in 2007 because it really changed the dynamics of these games to make Portal games interesting, where it feels like a first-person shooter. First-person shooter is you're walking around and your perspective is you have a gun in front of you and you shoot at things. But in Portal, you don't shoot bullets to destroy enemies. You're trapped in the Aperture Science Research Center, which I could basically describe as like an Apple store from hell. It's sleek, but it's an abandoned laboratory, and you're stuck in these rooms, and you have to try to solve puzzles to get out of them, and you have to like reach ledges or doors. And the way you do that is with your portal gun. Your gun shoots a beam, and it creates a portal, a hole on one end of the room, and that's the exit portal, and your second shot is like the entrance portal. It's been a long time since I played Portal. I think that's how it works. And so you create these portals where you could step through a wall where you made a hole, and you can emerge on the other side of the room. So it allows you to think fourth dimensionally. You need to think fourth dimensionally, Marty. Back to the Future. And so you would do that, and you would have to solve these puzzles and avoid robots and things that are trying to harm you and hazards. And you had to really expand your mind to think, how do I get from point A to point B? Oh, if I put, let's say, a portal behind me in the wall, and I put a portal at the bottom of this cliff I'm going to jump off, if I jump and I hit the hole at the bottom, I'll shoot out the portal I just put behind me. It's hard to explain here on audio, but look up Portal gameplay on YouTube. You see what I'm saying. It's incredibly addicting. According to Wikipedia, Portal was acclaimed as one of the most original games of 2007, despite criticisms of its short duration and limited story. That was improved in Portal 2. The game received praise for its originality, unique gameplay, and dark story with a humorous series of dialogue. GLaDOS, voiced by Ellen McClain in the English language version, received acclaim for her unique characterization and the end credits song, Still Alive. Yes, so the antagonist of the game, you're stuck in this research facility, you're trying to get out, is a artificial intelligence named GLaDOS, who always kind of seems helpful at first, but then like gives you this weird passive-aggressive kind of threats, things like that. I'm sorry to hear that. Uh-oh, you're about to be the current president of the Used to Be Alive Club. And so it's just things like that. You're dealing with GLaDOS and you hear it, and it's kind of creepy and endearing at the same time. So number 10 on my list definitely is going to have to go to Portal. Well, I got a top 10 list here. Originally, I thought I only had 8 or 9. So going from 1972 to 2007, those are, I believe, the greatest video games in the history of gaming. You may, if you're big into video games, you probably disagree with one or two items on this list that shouldn't have been there or were neglected. A top 10, when you're talking about the history of games and their development, I think it's a decent bit. And of course, I couldn't leave without sharing a clip from Portal, the end theme song. When you beat the game, you get this wonderful end credit song, which is sung by the villain, itself.
This was a triumph. I'm making a note here, huge success. It's hard to overstate my satisfaction. Aperture Science, we do what we must because we can, for the good. good of all of us, except the ones who are dead. But there's no sense crying over every mistake. You just keep on trying till you run out of cake. And the science gets done and you make a neat plan for the people who are still alive.
So that's where you can see the the kookiness of it here, that, you know, in the lyrics, those of us except those who are dead. So that's the kind of tone that you would get in the game. And so when you finally completed it, you got this screen and heard the theme song. And it was, I remember beating Portal for the first time and having this come up. And I just thought it was the coolest thing ever. I thought it was so fun. And I'm glad you all were with me today. I hope you enjoyed this Free For All Friday. You know, a lot of times we talk about history because history is one of my favorite things. I got a bachelor's in history. It's something I've studied for a long time. And I like looking at history from different angles, from art, science, military, culture, and yes, even video games. When you study something and it's endured for decades or centuries, it becomes kind of a mirror, especially in the arts, that it says more about the people around. When you look at art that's popular, it tells you a lot about the culture in which it is popular. So I hope that you really enjoyed the episode today. For those of you who enjoy these video games, if you like Portal, for example, I say, the cake is a lie, but what's not a lie is that I hope that you have a very blessed day and a very blessed weekend. Take care, and be sure to check out trendhornpodcast.com.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit trendhornpodcast.com.